I think it's always interesting to learn about the latest research on sustainable energy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And our guests today are going to talk about nuclear power and its potential to reduce carbon emissions. John Green, they're back. John, great to have you with us again.
A pleasure to be here.
John is comes by every couple of months, as a matter of fact. He directs education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and he always brings a guest with him. And today we have Paul Wilson. Paul is a professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He's interim chair of the Energy Analysis and Policy Grad Certificate Program. He's on the executive committee of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I definitely wanted to mention that as well. And Paul Wilson, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
I'm sure we'll get lots of comments today, so it'll be kind of fun. And I'm hoping you'll join in with your questions or comments. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, I'm going to start with a really very basic kind of question.
Yeah.
What is nuclear power and how does it actually work? Sometimes, you know, we've talked about it forever, but I'm not always sure that everybody's, myself included, understands how it all works. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So the brief version is that nuclear energy comes from uranium. We mine uranium out of the ground. In the United States, we enrich it slightly, ever so slightly, to make it more potent. And we put that uranium fuel into reactors. The reactors get hot, and ultimately we're boiling water. So a nuclear power plant is not that dissimilar from a coal power plant in that respect. We boil the water, we produce steam, we run that through a turbine, and it spins to produce electricity. The nuclear fuel stays in the reactor about 6 years or so, and then it comes out, goes in a pool at the reactor site, and ultimately gets stored above ground.
And what's the status of nuclear power here in Wisconsin?
So Wisconsin has had four power reactors historically. Two of them are still operating. The first to shut down was actually a very innovative La Crosse boiling water reactor. It was shut down in the 80s already, built by Alice Chalmers out of Milwaukee, sort of interesting little fact. Mm-hmm. There were three power reactors operating for a very long time. Most recently, Kewaunee shut down just about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. A very very strongly operating reactor. It was bought by Dominion a few years ago. They shut down mostly because of the cheap natural gas. And Point Beach has two reactors, and they're still operating today.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me at least to learn about the percentage of our power that's actually comes from nuclear, both in Wisconsin and nationally, and you have some figures on that.
Sure. So in Wisconsin, it for a long time was 20%. Since we've lost Kewaunee, that's dropped now. It's more like 15%. So it's a pretty big, it's a sizable fraction of our electricity supply. Nationally, it's still close to 20%. We have 100 reactors operating around the country. We're the biggest nuclear energy country in the world, despite most people's thoughts that it's, most people have heard of France and they always think of France. Well, the United States is about twice as big as France in terms of how much nuclear energy we produce.
And you're in favor, there's a moratorium. Maybe, John, Paul, do you want to talk about the moratorium?
Yeah, I think Paul's more up on it. He's been more involved, so I'll pass it. Thank you.
So in the early 80s, legislation was passed that would add two specific requirements for building a new nuclear power plant in Wisconsin. The first of these, by my reading, is really sort of a generic topic that is true of any energy system in that it had to be economically beneficial for the citizens of Wisconsin. And if I look at, the Public Service Commission, that's their job for anybody who wants to build a coal plant, natural gas, wind plant, anything. Mm-hmm. So that always seemed to me to be a little redundant. The second one, which was really more important, said that there had to be operating a permanent disposal facility for used nuclear fuel. And that has not come to fruition. Back in 1983, we were in the middle of deciding what we were going to do about that nationally. Since 1987, we've been pursuing a site at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. And the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, became the body responsible for solving this problem. And they signed contracts with all of these reactors saying that they would take care of this problem by 1998. And we're still waiting today to figure out how they're going to do that. So they've submitted a license application for Yucca Mountain. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has largely addressed that and determined that it seems like a pretty viable possibility, and we're sort of at the final stage now where it's going to be up to the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners themselves to decide if they want to grant a license for that facility.
Talking with John Greenler and Paul Wilson today, John directs education for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Paul, professor of nuclear engineering at the UW-Madison. He's on the executive committee of the Wisconsin Energy Institute as we talk with them about nuclear power. I'm going to join in. We have lots of people who have questions, so let's take some calls. And Ray in Milwaukee, thank you for waiting. Hello, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. I have 2 points, and I'd like both guests to address both points. The first point is the statement the guest just made that nuclear power is a zero carbon emitter. But he admitted in that statement that we have to mine the uranium first, and then it has to be processed, which are all done using fossil fuels. And the area on the mine, which is often on Native American territory, that area is left unlivable for the next 10, 20,000 years. So that is number one. Number two, we just had the Paris attacks in Paris. We lived through 9/11 in this country. What if on those days, those people, whoever it was, had decided to attack not the nuclear power plant itself, but the storage areas for the spent fuel? There is no way we're going to protect all of that all around the world at any time while this war machine we have going full tilt is killing people around the world. People are going to stay angry for generations. So if you could address both of them, and if you really do believe in nuclear power, move your families next to Point Beach, and in 20 or 30 years, let me know the cancer rates of your children.
All right. Paul Wilson, let's turn to you.
Sure. So I'll first on the first point, I don't believe I ever said it was a zero carbon emission. Certainly, it's a low carbon emission. You're absolutely correct that when you look at the full life cycle of a nuclear power plant and you look at what it takes to mine the fuel, process the fuel, build the power plant itself, and so on, that does contribute to carbon emissions. However, those carbon emissions time and again have been shown over the life cycle of the entire facility to be basically the same, in some studies lower than, as wind energy and solar energy. And so I feel that that's really a false dichotomy that people create to pit nuclear energy against other low-emission sources. Today we have the climate change meetings starting in Paris, and the only thing we know for sure is that we need to take advantage of everything we have to reduce our carbon emissions. And to try and pit nuclear energy against other renewables is really distracting from the real problem, which is that we need to be displacing fossil fuels. And so I consider nuclear and wind and solar and other renewables, from an emissions point of view, to really be in the same camp. You raised this question of security as well. Shortly after 9/11, major analysis was done of all of our infrastructure in the United States. And the highest grade was given to nuclear power plants. Of all the infrastructure that was assessed, whether it's water treatment plants, sewage treatment plants, refineries, chemical plants, nuclear power plants were the most prepared and had been designed with the most security in mind to prevent the kinds of attacks from really being a danger. And so, not to give anybody ideas, but if I was trying to attack the United States, it would not be a nuclear power plant I'd be going after. There's a lot of other softer targets where I'd really be focusing my effort.
The other point brought was had to do with the land and mining.
Right. I was going to raise that up as well because I think it is an important consideration in terms of land use. And it is interesting, you know, I think we look at all of our different energy sources and, you know, land use concerns are something which are frequently ignored, but, you know, really are pervasive. You know, and as for, it's the same as for carbon emissions. When we look at, when we compare to things like wind and solar, there are also, in that situation, significant land use concerns as well. And we really need to look at all these different pieces, do very careful, quantitative analysis to real, you know, look at the life cycle assessments and comparing the different opportunities. But once again, yes, it's, you know, there are issues there, but, you know, there are issues with the other, low carbon emitting, more sustainable sources as well.
And I'll just also address briefly this question, the environmental justice question that was raised there as mm-hmm. well. Certainly in the United States, historically, there's a pretty poor record of uranium mining and interactions with the native populations. And the Four Corners area is really the hot spot for that. That all happened decades ago. Uranium mining in the United States typically is not a concern. Most of the uranium that we use in the United States is coming from Canada, Australia, Kazakhstan. And those countries have learned from the experience in the U.S. and themselves over the years and have really learned how to do this in a much cleaner way and do this in operations that are much safer today than they were in the sort of bad times of the late 50s in the United States.
James in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there. James, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was going to address that carbon thing because Dr. Helen Caldicott said it's the highest carbon energy source we can get, but it was already addressed there. John Goffman was the head medical officer for the NRC, and he was asked by Congress to come up with a figure of how many people died every year from operating nuclear power plants in the United States. And his figure, after the years of studying this, was from routine releases from nuclear power plants was 35,000 deaths a year, and he was fired immediately after that. So I think that you have to take into account all the cost. It's just not even carbon and stuff, and the intermittency is a really bad problem there. I've got PV, and I get more power out of my system than I can use because I got time of day rates on a cloudy day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and then like at Fukushima, four of those plants were shut down for like 6 months for routine maintenance.
All right, comments, and let's turn to Paul Wilson. Paul?
Well, let me sort of go in the reverse order there. I think the intermittency one I'm a little puzzled by because nuclear energy is actually the most stable form of electricity production in the country and around the world. Nuclear power plants, if you look at the average across 100 reactors in the United States, are operating 92% of the time. They do have to shut down to refuel occasionally. They almost always shut down in the spring and the fall when the electricity demand is the lowest, and it has almost no impact on the grid when they shut down. So it's a little puzzling to hear a concern about intermittency. To go back to this question of health effects, I'm not familiar with that study. Certainly it's not consistent with all the evidence we have from other sources. Radiation is a natural part of our world. Humans have been living with radiation since we emerged from our primal forms, and there's a lot of evidence that low levels of radiation are not in fact harmful, and there's no evidence on a really strongly peer-reviewed basis that nuclear power plants are contributing to radiological health consequences like you're suggesting. I'm going to have to go back and look and see what Dr. Goffman had to say, but there seems to be no evidence that that's really true, especially when you compare it to the amount of radiation exposure we're all getting from medical procedures in this day and age.
Yeah, and we get... What is the difference?
So we get... They recently upgraded the estimates of how much radiation everybody's exposed to on average in the United States. About half of it is coming from medical procedures today, x-rays, CT scans. This is not everybody, of course, experiences that, but the average person does. And the other half of it comes from natural sources, from the earth around us. Somebody joked a couple weeks ago up at the Capitol here in Madison that the granite that building is built out of is actually a very high source of natural radioactivity. And so the cosmic rays, natural ground, and so on. If you look at how much nuclear energy is expected to contribute to that, it's sort of about less than 1 out of 600 of the total radiation that we're exposed to on average naturally.
Talking today about nuclear power and how it fits in our changing energy landscape, two guests for you today, John Greenler of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and Paul Wilson, professor of nuclear engineering, interim chair of the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at nuclear power today with our guests John Greenler and Paul Wilson. Thanks so much for joining us. You can ask your own question or make a comment at 1-800-642-1234. You could email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ray and Rhinelander wondered if you could explain the difference between fission reactors and fusion reactors. You want to take that on, Paul?
Sure. So we actually have a lot of research in both those areas here at the UW. Fission reactors are the kind of reactors that we have today producing electricity. They rely on taking a very heavy element and separating it in half. Basically, this is Einstein's famous law in action. We take the mass from that very heavy thing, we separate it in half, and some of it gets turned into energy. It turns out the way the nature works, if you take very light things and you squeeze them together, they will fuse. This is what fusion is. This is what happens in the sun and the stars. And these, when they combine together, some mass is converted to energy. And so very light things can be combined together to produce fusion energy and very heavy things separated. Fusion energy is, it's pretty challenging to get these things to combine together. So the typical approach is to heat them up to very, very high temperatures, so hot that you can't actually contain it. And then you need to use magnetic fields and other things to contain it. And so this is one of the challenges in achieving fusion energy, is finding the container, if you will, that will be stable and hold all this together.
And what is your own, talk about your own research a little bit, if you can.
Sure. So one of the big areas of my research is actually looking at the future of nuclear energy over decades and centuries and understanding what the implications will be as we change technologies. So if we look out to what we call Generation 3 Plus or Generation 4 technology in the future for nuclear energy, trying to understand how the opportunity to recycle, use nuclear fuel, deploy different kinds of reactors will actually affect the costs, the social, political implications, the proliferation risks, things like that, in the future of nuclear energy. And so we build software that lets us look at the complexity of that as it emerges.
Interesting. Chris in Port Wing has a question for you, so let's go there next. Chris, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the program, Larry. I'm interested in what your guest's enthusiasm is based on. I would encourage you to take an alternative look and get Arjun Makhijani, who wrote Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy, a number of years ago. He did a very in-depth study on what it would take to get to a carbon-free economy and based it on an understanding that when you take the entire life cycle of nuclear power into consideration, including the long-term storage, which takes tens of thousands of years, longer than the recorded human history of humans on the planet, the expense alone makes it a loser. In fact, Jeremy Rifkin, one of the noted economists in the energy field, said that he stopped even debating people about nukes years ago because they're unaffordable so far.
Well, I want to break in here because I want to give Paul a chance to respond to your questions, Chris.
Sure. So I think the first question was this question on carbon and sort of flowed into a question on cost of used nuclear fuel disposal. So I think that the estimates that have been done time and time again show what the costs would be for implementing Yucca Mountain and disposing of spent nuclear fuel in Yucca Mountain. And the reality is that everybody in the country has been paying for that solution for the last nearly 30 years. So in 1987, as part of figuring out how to manage this challenge, the federal government instituted the nuclear waste fee, and every single time one of us buys electricity that comes from nuclear energy, we're paying into a fund which has been shown over and over again to be able to pay for the construction operation of Yucca Mountain and ultimately dispose of the waste. I think it's very timely when we think about a world worrying about carbon, and we have such a difficulty establishing a carbon tax, something that would be a policy measure that would have a dramatic impact on our ability to address the carbon problem, that in fact for nearly 30 years we've had a nuclear waste tax. And we've all been paying it, and it's been there for the express purpose of disposing of this. By the same token, and I should say that it's a fraction of the cost of nuclear energy. It's a nearly imperceptible fraction of the total cost of nuclear energy. And so by the same token, that sort of gives you an estimate of what the carbon emissions would be of spent nuclear fuel disposal. And it's nice to talk about the long timelines, but there's no active carbon emission that happens over those long timelines. We build the repository over a few decades, we put the used nuclear fuel underground and we seal it, and there's no more carbon emissions happening after that. And so the total carbon emissions, like I say, there are many different estimates. I'm familiar with Makhijani's work. He's an outlier. If you look at the total number of people who've looked at this question, most of them find that it's in the order of, you know, it's 20 to 30 times lower than coal for nuclear, and it's about the same as wind and solar, time and time again.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Chris. I want to give Gus in Fitchburg a chance to join us. Gus, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. Yes, I had a question. I've read that in either Scientific America or Wired magazine that there's another isotope out there that's safer and more sustainable to mine, and it's you can build smaller reactors with it, and also that there's a couple test reactors in the Tennessee Valley Authority. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Sure.
Sure. So what you're referring to is probably thorium. Thorium and uranium both exist naturally in the Earth's crust. Thorium is a little bit more common, but you know, only two or three times more. In some countries, it's much more common, and India is the most interested in this because they have a lot of thorium, not much uranium, and until about 5 or 6 years ago, didn't have much access to the rest of the world's nuclear technology. Now, like you suggested, you can read lots of articles talking about some of the nifty things you can do with thorium, but when you actually get down and look at the details, the thorium and uranium are pretty similar. One of the key differences is that there is no naturally occurring form of thorium that you can directly use to produce nuclear energy. You actually have to convert the thorium in a reactor to uranium and then consume that uranium in the reactor. Well, this is nearly identical to a process that we've been exploring since the beginning of the nuclear age, which takes some of the uranium and converts it to plutonium and consumes that in a nuclear reactor. And so the thorium-uranium cycle that we sometimes refer to and the uranium-plutonium cycle, once you get down to it, are within a 10% of 20% of each other, nearly the same thing. And so all the things you can do with thorium-uranium, you can typically do with uranium-plutonium, and that's where we've had more research. So I don't think thorium's a bad idea. I'm just really not so optimistic that it's a silver bullet that offers a lot of very different ideas from the uranium-plutonium options. It's just that sometimes when you see people who are proponents of thorium present it, they sort of are comparing apples to oranges by comparing it to our existing uranium fuel cycle.
There we go. Gus, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Bruce in Kewaunee County, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning.
Morning.
You touched on Yucca Mountain, and that has always been, I think, living in Kewaunee County, a sore subject for me. I feel that the decision was to not use it was strictly political, and it you know, as was mentioned, we spent billions of dollars developing it, and I think Harry Reid, for political reasons, blocked it. I would like your experts to discuss this, the real science behind Yucca Mountain. Was it a viable possibility?
All right, thanks for calling, Bruce, and back to you, Paul Wilson.
Sure. So Yucca Mountain actually continues to be a viable possibility from a technical point of view. So as you said, in 1987, Yucca Mountain was chosen as the primary site for us to explore. We spent billions of dollars of geological work primarily. Some of the researchers here at UW were involved, trying to understand whether it was in fact a fit site for this purpose. That was determined in the early 2000s. A full license application was filed in 2008. And that sort of stood 5 or 6 feet tall of paper with all the analysis they'd done over the years. And the primary way that they analyzed that, because as one of the earlier callers said, it's a very long-term problem. It's a engineering challenge that forces us to face timescales longer than we have human record. And so what they did was analyzed this site under all the possible futures they could imagine of that time frame. And they used an approach where you simulate many, many hundreds of thousands of different possible futures and look at what the outcomes might be. And the outcome of that kind of analysis showed that this site could, if designed properly and with all the engineering barriers that they combined with the natural barriers, would be sufficient to meet the licensing requirements for 1 million years. And so they submitted that license application in 2008. As the caller suggested, round about the time of elections, there were some political obstacles that got amplified. They were always there. Harry Reid was the leader of the Senate, and he was from Nevada and had a long career of opposing Yucca Mountain. And so it created some complications. But the important thing that hasn't made as much press is that while the Obama administration attempted to withdraw that license application, they were, in fact, in 2013, a federal court found that that was illegal, and they could not do that. And so the license application is actually going forward today. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is studying the license, has written a safety analysis report where they, or has judged the safety analysis report. All indications I have are that they are in favor of granting such a license. And as I said earlier, we're waiting for the time at which that sort of moves forward in what is probably at this point still a political process.
So it's still in the works.
It's still in the works. Whether or not it's a non-starter politically is still yet to be determined. Certainly the House of Representatives is very bullish on Yucca Mountain and would like to see it move forward. The Senate has more complication in it, and it really probably needs a political scientist on the show to help you understand the next steps.
Ron in Sparta has a question next. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I know that a lot of other countries have built new nuclear plants after the U.S. had most of theirs complete, and I was wondering about the new breeder reactors, how successful they are at eliminating that waste issue that everybody is so concerned about, if they're more environmentally safe, and what's the update on those if we propose to build anything new in Wisconsin or not. And also the new information on solar energy. I'm not wondering if your engineers are familiar with that, where the these new super high efficient solar energy panels that they say are going to reduce our per kilowatt cost to 5 cents and under. And I wonder if there's any validity to that. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Ron, for calling. A couple of things. Paul, you want to start?
So the caller, I mean, was referring to sort of broadly to future reactor technology, and specific mentioned breeder reactors. So this is a technology, again, that, that the very first electricity ever produced from nuclear energy was, in fact, a breeder reactor out in Idaho, four light bulbs strung across the top of the reactor back in the 1950s. And this technology has been studied over and over again. Currently, the biggest reactors operating like this are in Russia, and the United States operated an experimental reactor through the 80s and 90s out in Idaho again. So we have a pretty good understanding of how this technology works. The biggest issue is that it's expected, by all estimates, to be a little bit more expensive than the current technology. And so getting utilities interested in such a very competitive energy market to spend money on more, slightly more expensive technology is a challenge. And so until we have policy instruments that are going to create incentives for that, it's unlikely to happen. The other little factor there is that in order to use these advanced reactors, you need some sort of recycling system, probably a large factory that would do recycling of used nuclear fuel. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, when we were pursuing that, the industry was all targeted towards that kind of plan. Then a number of political actions at that point shut that business down. And so for industrial partners to get interested in that again, they're pretty gun-shy that they were doing it once and then they got shut out of it. So the final point I'll say is that if we were able to pursue that, this is some of the work that I look at, we'd be able to take the used nuclear fuel problem that I like to say, you know, for a person getting all their electricity from nuclear energy for their entire lifetime, their used nuclear fuel would be about one soda can's worth or one beer can's worth of used nuclear fuel. If we were to use these advanced recycling systems and reactors, you could reduce that maybe to a shot glass worth for entire life of electricity.
So really cut back.
Yeah.
And John, did you want to address the other?
Yeah, I can briefly touch base on the solar photovoltaic and efficiency question. And it is an interesting one. You know, there's over a different photovoltaic technologies that are out there, pretty wide ranging, and one of the dimensions of that is efficiency. And you can get solar panels that are over 50% efficient, and they are actually in use today. But they're very, very expensive. So the places where you see them, for example, are like satellites, where every square centimeter that you launch is very, very high value. Interestingly, it now looks like in terms of cost per kilowatt hour for the photovoltaics, we may actually be looking at some slightly less efficient panels, but ones that are very, very economical to produce. So, you know, today I think the panels that are going up on people's roofs are maybe like in the 10 to 12% efficiency category. And clearly we want that to be as high as possible, but production costs are really a critical variable in those calculations. And so it actually may be that we see a little bit of drop in efficiency per panel, but get some big rewards in terms of cost per kilowatt hour. So
interesting. Bill in La Crosse has a question. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. It seems to me that the ultimate answer is for most of these problems that have been talked about is the fusion prospect. What is your opinion on the possibility we will see anything there worthwhile within our lifetime?
There's a lot of research going on there. We do some here at the UW. There's a big experiment being built in the south of France that's really considered the next step, the ITER project, and we do some work. I do some work in support of that project as well. I think that many people have made predictions about the future of nuclear fusion and been proven wrong. So I'm loath to pick a date. You know, I think that we will see nuclear fusion emerge at some point. There's still a lot of engineering challenges. And one of the things that we hear more and more talk about, is particularly with this large project in France, is that we're nearing the point where we may be switching from being more of a science program to more of an engineering and energy program. There's still a lot of understanding we need to understand how these large, difficult-to-control systems work. But once we get the core, the plasma at the center of these fusion reactors working, then it'll turn into an engineering problem. How do we make a system that converts all that to useful electricity?
Interesting. Bill, thanks again for calling. And let's turn to Gene in Madison next. Hi, Gene. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Given that Dairyland has been sitting there empty for years, what is the prospects of it withstanding a once-in-a-thousand-year flood, considering did your models that you talk about so bravely predict Fukushima? And what happens when Diablo Canyon gets a Fukushima? I bet your models didn't predict Fukushima.
So a couple different points there. I think that one of the things we found after Fukushima is that there are many people's models did predict Fukushima, and that there was a regulatory failure in Japan, one that we are working to learn from, if there's lessons to learn, although, frankly, one that we might have been able to identify ahead of time. The United States has a very separated regulator. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is at great arm's length from the government. And in Japan, prior to Fukushima, the regulator was really closely tied to the Department of Energy equivalent. And so the separation we've had for decades here in the United States is now the model of how Japan has changed their regulatory environment. On the topic of the flood proposition in the Mississippi, at this point in time, the Dairyland Power Reactor is just a spent fuel sitting, being cooled. And so the challenge of a flood in a... To try and connect the two, in Fukushima, what happened with the tsunami is it prevented the reactor from being able to maintain cooling. In the Dairyland Power La Crosse Boiling Water Reactor, that reactor has been shut down forever. It doesn't need to maintain cooling in the same sort of way. And so the kind of flooding that you might happen, even if it were to happen, of the Mississippi, is really not a risk to the used nuclear fuel that's stored there.
Interesting. Okay, thank you very much for calling. And Tim in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, it seems like the big issue with nuclear power is the disposal of, you know, spent fuels. And I'm wondering, you know, could we ever get to the point, is it possible that do something like the Manhattan Project, where we put all the brainiacs in the world together and try and come up with a way to completely, you know, neutralize the spent, you know, the disposal fuel, or, you know, something real out of this world, not, I suppose literally, is it possible to shoot nuclear waste to, you know, the sun and burn it up, or, you know, send it up to Mars or something? I know that sounds futuristic, but is that ever a possibility?
All right. Thanks for calling, Tim. A couple of things there.
Sure. So let's start with the original question of the notion of neutralizing used nuclear fuel. Really, the best prospect there is to get involved with something, some sort of recycling. Now, we do recycling in lots of parts of our economy, and so we're pretty familiar with the concept of recycling. When you take fuel out of a reactor, over 90% of it is the same stuff you put in. It's the same stuff you mined out of the ground in the first place. So the first thing you can do is just separate these pieces out and make it a much smaller volume problem. Basically, what I like to say is when you take the uranium out of the reactor, about 5% of it is lighter than uranium, and about 5% of it is heavier than uranium, and the rest of it is the same uranium you put in the first place. The heavier than uranium part is the part that really takes a long, long time to deal with. The lighter than uranium part is radioactive, but it usually is considered to be more of a few hundred year problem than a few tens of thousands of year problem. So if we can separate those three parts and then deal with them separately, it gives us a lot of opportunity. The heavier than uranium part is what you might put into one of those breeder reactors that an earlier caller talked about, ultimately causing fission there and converting those to the lighter than uranium part that you can then have as a 300 year problem. So that's sort of as good as you can get, at least with what we understand today. Now, one of the challenges with doing that is the cost of building up that whole process. As I said, the nuclear fuel cycle today is pretty inexpensive, and so trying to imagine how you do it, that recycling would be a big challenge. And frankly, the nuclear waste problem, as much as we are worried about that problem today, it's really not a big enough problem to mobilize enough people to want to spend more money to deal with that problem. Let's briefly on this last topic of space. And we decided many years ago internationally in treaties not to send this stuff into space. We've seen the Challengers, we've seen the Columbias, we've seen all kinds of reasons why we probably don't want to take that approach. Even if we found safer ways to launch it, it probably is still something we'd want to think twice about.
Mm-hmm. Wow. The time has flown by today. Hasn't it, John?
It has. Hey, just briefly, if you're interested in this topic, I would really recommend going to energy.wisc.edu. Currently on our homepage, there actually is a feature article on this topic and Paul's work as well. So just an opportunity there.
And I think we have a link to on our Facebook page as well.
I think that's right.
So certainly take a look at that. And thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure.
John Greenler directs education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Paul Wilson, professor of nuclear engineering, interim chair of the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program at UW. He's on the executive committee of the Wisconsin Energy Institute as well. Interesting times, aren't they? And it was great to have them come by to talk about nuclear energy. And here it is, the last Monday of the month, which also means that it's a great time to talk about weather and global warming and El Nino. And our weather guys coming up next will talk about just that.